Shaquita Smith is a trailblazer. When she realized there had never been a Black female on the cover of a comic book as a superhero, she decided to change that. In 2016, Shaquita launched the multimedia company She-Ro Comics and eventually held the first all-female comic convention, She-Ro-Con. Not to mention that for more than 15 years, she's been writing and directing films and award-winning screenplays featuring powerful women. Now she's branching out into the gaming industry with a new division of her company, She-Ro Games. On the show, she shares why her ability to pivot is her superpower, why she believes more people should consider crowdfunding to raise money for their businesses, and why she thinks getting into the gaming industry is a game changer. Let's get into the show. Another special guest on the show, and I am so impressed with her because, one, she's in a male-dominated industry, and she is a game changer, literally game changer. I love that little play on word. But I'm happy to welcome Shaquita Smith. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one of the things I want to say, we just heard your resume and all the great things that you're doing, and what I always like to start out the question with is, what do you believe is the secret behind your success? Because I know you're still growing and stuff, but you've done some pretty amazing things to date. And I have to ask that question.
I think it's like my ability to pivot. So like things change and I'm able to kind of like, okay, land on my feet. This is what we're going to do now, whatever. So like a lot of things come up, a lot of things have happened that haven't been planned. And it's just like, okay, let's just go with the flow. So rolling with it is what's helped me.
And why do you think that's so critical? Because I think a lot of people, when they go into entrepreneurship or they're pursuing a dream, they have this vision and they think it has to be just like this.
Yes.
And that often keeps people stuck because they can't see it any other way. Mm-hmm. So why was that such an impactful thing for you to pivot?
I think it's because I come from a sales background. So like you couldn't control anything there. I used to work for Coca-Cola for about 6 years. The motto there was control what you can control, because there's so many other things that you won't be able to control in this industry. So I came from into entrepreneurship with that mindset. And so I think that's what's helped me, is to be able to like, okay, I can't control that, but we can pivot over and do this right now or whatever. So it's just kind of like taking it as it comes and being able to adjust.
That's huge. And I think, like you said, being able to adjust, but how do you often know when it's time to pivot? Because I think a lot of times, you know, we are, like I said, we're laser focused, but you said you're, one of your secrets is knowing when to pivot. So how do you know? Is it a gut feeling? Like, what usually is the indication for you?
It is totally a gut feeling. That's what's helped me so far, is just being able to, it's not even just a gut feeling. It's like, you have to believe your gut.
Ooh.
Cause that's the problem. Cause for so long, a lot of times I would like feel something or feel like, okay, I should or shouldn't do this, but then I wouldn't believe it. And so then it would happen eventually, but it was just like, okay, I could have just went straight here instead of going above and beyond and a roller coaster or whatever. So it's just like trusting yourself and trusting your gut is something I think it's hard for a lot of women to do, because you're like doubting yourself anyway. And there's all this sexism and stuff that makes you kind of like wonder like, okay, am I doing this right or whatever? Because the men, they just come through and they dominate. But with us, it's kind of like we kind of doubt ourselves because of the way society is set up. So trusting your gut is like really, I think, what helps me pivot. It and move on from things or whatever quickly.
How did you learn to do that? Because that's a mindset, right?
Yes,
learning
is.
To trust your gut. Was that because you said, because even as I heard you say that, it sounds like there were times where you didn't initially.
Yes.
You know, like where you got that feeling and you're like, oh, I don't know, should I do this? So was there a story or a moment that you recall or something, that mindset shift that shifted for you that said, I can trust this now?
Probably in 2018, I wanted to go on this tour, this international tour, to take my books overseas. I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. I had someone that said they were going to invest in me. They pulled out at the last minute. So I was just like, how am I going to make this work? Because I wanted to go to Korea. We went to New York, Indonesia. We wanted to go to Mexico and Africa, South Africa. I was like, how can I afford to do this on my own or whatever? And so that person pulled out. And then the next week I was like, okay, am I going to do this or not? And then I talked to one of my friends and he was just like, you know, the only thing that stands in our way is money. Like, that's it. Like, anything else we can do. And so I took out a small loan and we went to Korea. And so we spent the week in Korea filming the documentary and going to comic cons. And we shot like footage of me kind of, because the book, the series Raven Choi is based on my trip to Korea. It was like, I was inspired by it after I came back in Korea 20 years ago on a study abroad trip. And so, yeah, we went to Korea. And once we got to Korea and filmed and came back, it was like, okay, New York is next. And so New York, they gave me a table at New York Comic Con, even though it was sold out. And so we took the cameras there. And so then Indonesia came up. And then one of my cousins invested and helped me get tickets for my crew and for me to go there. And thankfully, it was inexpensive. But once I did that, it was just like anything is possible. And that's what got me to believing my gut, because I trusted myself and my ability to go to Korea and shoot a documentary in a foreign place that I had no permits for.
Girl, but that's huge.
It was crazy. So after doing that, it was just like, okay, Shaquita, you can do anything you put your mind to. And then a few months later, ShiroCon came up, which was like my own comic convention. I kind of just kind of fell into that because I knew it was going to come. My intern even mentioned it. She's like, oh, you're probably going to do ShiroCon. I'm like, yeah, a couple years from now, maybe 3 years from now. That didn't happen 3 years from now. It happened a couple months later. And so, yeah, so that was another thing of trusting my gut. And I was telling one of my friends this. I feel like I kept trying to do things small. And it's like, oh, I'm just going to do this little thing right here. And God kept telling me, no, bigger. Ooh. And so I was, oh, I'm just going to move it up to right here. And God was just like, no, bigger. And so I'm just like, okay. Because like with ShiroCon, I was going to do a comic convention inside of a comic book store. That was how it started out. So I called the mall. So let me see if they're doing anything that we can kind of go sell some books at. So I called them and they were just like, yeah, we didn't have nothing going on for Women's History Month, but we like that idea. And I was just like, okay. They were like, can you do it here? And I was just like, okay. And so then I was like, okay, we'll have some tables in the middle of the mall, just do like kind of like a rummage sale thing. And they were like, do you want a stage? And I was like, a stage? What do you need a stage for? And so I was just like, there was a small stage. And they were like, well, you want the big stage? And I'm just like, well, the big stage? What do we need a big stage for? And so by the time, this was 4 weeks. So by the time we got to ShiroCon, we had a stage. I had women that came and spoke from like Black Panther and all these other places, these other like DC Batman or whatever. So it's like the composer. There were like hundreds and thousands of people there. We had like in the middle of the mall, we took over the center court of the mall and had all these female creators selling their comic books and their t-shirts and trinkets or whatever that they had. And yeah, people came and they were dressed up in cosplay. And I'm just like, how did I get a Comic Con? But that was one of those things where it was just like, we're just going to have some tables. And it ends up being a stage and a big production. And that was God telling me I need to do something bigger. And so once that happened, it's just like, okay, that's really, I just have to listen to where he's guiding me to and listen to my gut. So that's kind of how that process happened for me.
No, I think, and faith is a big part of my life as well in terms of like guiding me and letting me know where to go. But one of the things that you said that really stood out to me is that you invested in yourself.
Yes.
A lot of times, you know, I always say that you're your first investor. And why should another company, I always say this to people, like, why should another company invest thousands of dollars in you when many of us aren't really willing to take the risk and invest in ourselves?
Yes.
So why was it so important to you, and how did you even get the courage to say, you know what, this person backed out, or this, you know, group that was going to sponsor what I really wanted to do, you know what, I'm going to invest in myself, I'm going to take the risk.
I'm a risk taker, so that kind of, I mean, it was just like I had nothing to lose, really. It was just like, okay, I have a job, I'm making money, I can pay this loan back, you know, as long as I have a check coming in, I'll pay it back. It's like a credit card. So it was like, I think it was like $15,000. So I took $15,000 to doing this trip. And it's just like, once I record this and start documenting what I'm doing, I have a documentary or a docuseries that I'll be able to sell later. So I'm like, I'm always going to bet on myself. I'm not going to lose my money. I'm a winner. That's kind of how I operate. So it's just like, this is not a losing game here. So it's just like, no matter what you do. And in a couple of months, I paid that loan off. And now I have a documentary. We're still shooting it, actually, just to kind of show how I built the whole company as a whole. So now we're in games. So like once we finish the gaming thing or whatever, then we'll probably release the docuseries. But yeah, it was just like, I felt like this was a good idea. I felt like I had to do this. And so by any means necessary, that's really what it was. It was like, this has to happen. So I got that small loan and we were on the plane the next week.
Was there any fear? I mean, oh, yeah. Girl, you went out of the country. I mean, I know you said, I mean, I hear you like, I'm a winner, but in your mind, you know, you're a winner. You know, most of us, okay. You know, but how did you get past the The fear, was there that fear, and how did you get past it?
I don't think I gave myself time to have fear because everything happened so fast. It was just like either sink or swim. That's what I learned at Coca-Cola. Like, we got there, they trained us for like several weeks. It was just like the biggest training they'd ever done for like sales reps. And at the end of the training, it was like, we were just like, it was sink or swim. You're going to go sell now. And we were out in the field like, okay, let me go find some customers. So it was like, I come up in that training. So it was kind of like that mindset too. Like, okay, this is either sink or swim. It happened so fast that I didn't have time to really doubt myself, because it was like, we were on a plane next week and then we had to find a DP that was going to come along with us. And I wanted to find a DP that spoke the language, at least some of the language. So I wanted to find a Korean DP, which we did. And he spoke some of the language, so he kind of helped us along the way, even though like a lot of people in Korea speak English anyway. It's a really English friendly country. But still, it was like there were times where it could have ended differently. Because in the airport, we did not have a permit to shoot in the airport. And I was just like, well, we're going to get some footage of me like going around the airport or whatever. And so they didn't stop me. They just kind of, they like, people were looking like, who's that girl with a camera following her? And there was a Korean guy recording me. So they just figured I was there, you know, I was supposed to be there. Because I think if you act like you're supposed to be there, then people don't really question you. So we did that to get our footage. And then the cops came, the airport police came over. They wouldn't talk to me. They talked to my DP because he's a man. So they wouldn't talk to a woman. So they talked to him. And I was just like, well, we got all we need at this point. So we're good.
I love that. Well, girl, you dropped a couple golden nuggets right there. One, when you said, and when you act like you're supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Even in life, even in business, when you act like you're supposed to be there, people don't question it.
Nope.
Girl, that was a mic drop right there. And then I know you talked about that you were a risk taker. Have you always been a risk taker? And was this something that you just, you know, as you were growing up, you realized that in order to have big rewards, you had to take big risks?
I don't know when I was growing. I mean, I've always been just like a little bit offbeat, off center. I'm never like following the crowd. I'm a Gemini. I'm kind of like in my own little world over here doing things. So I've always kind of been like that. I think the biggest risk that I took was moving to Los Angeles. Like after I graduated college, I used to intern with Def Jam. So it was, the decision was, are you going to go to New York and work with Def Jam? Or are you going to go to LA and pursue writing? Because I fallen in love with screenwriting. And so I made the decision to move to LA and drove cross country. And it was very quickly too. It was like, okay, I want to go. I came out here and visited some friends that were here. And then it was like, oh, okay, I want to move here, whatever. I don't have a job. I don't have a place to stay. And so one of the people I knew from back home, her mom lived out here and she had a room. She's like, well, my mom's renting a room for this much. And I was just like, okay, that seems affordable. And so I think in like 2 weeks I was driving cross country. So it was like really spur of the moment type of move to LA on the verge.
Girl, you are a jump off the cliff kind of person.
That's exactly who I am. Even though I'm not doing that in real life, I'm not jumping out of a plane, but that's the way I do things in a rhetorical way, I guess. I don't know.
I love it because, you know, a lot of times many of us have these big dreams, but we're afraid to go after it. And I always say little risk, mm-hmm. often little reward.
Yes.
You got to jump off the cliff.
Yes, you do.
You have to take that opportunity to see, because like, what's the worst that can happen? Like you said, even when you took the loan out, you're like, well, if it doesn't work out, guess what? I got a job. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay this back.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to where it first started for you, because I love to go back to people's childhood dreams and figure out how you got to where you were. Where you are now. So tell me, as a child, were you the kid who loved to read comics? Like, what was your childhood dream and how did you find that you were even interested in gaming and comics and film and all of that?
Well, I was an only child, even though I have like 11 cousins that are younger than me, that we all grew up in the same area. But I was only child, so I was always playing Nintendo and playing by myself and playing and creating by myself. I was always drawing something or writing a poem or like just playing like games, whether it was board games or playing Nintendo with my cousins. So the gaming thing, that was always there. I mean, like I was in love with Japan. I always thought Japan was going to be the place that changed my life, because on the back of Nintendo, it says made in Japan. So I was like, wow, this place is so cool. They created all of these games that are so fun. Like we got Super Mario and Duck Hunt and like the Mike Tyson game, like the WWE or whatever. And so it was just like, okay. So I knew that, but I was always a creative child. So like we would get together with my cousins. I was the one directing the production of like, okay, you guys, we were in a movie, you guys kiss or whatever. So like, still to this day, my cousins are like, yeah, you made us kiss or whatever. I'm just like, yeah. we're shooting something. So we were always shooting something. Or I was always doing something creative. But then when I was like 16, I came out to Los Angeles to visit my cousins that lived here. And when I left, this is kind of how you know how other people see you. when I left, everybody back home, like friends and family, they all thought I was going to end up on Soul Train. That's just kind of how they figured that I was going to be something or somebody. And so they were looking for me to be on Soul Train because they were like, she's going to end up somewhere. I didn't end up on Soul Train, but I wanted to be a model. That was my thing. It was supermodel age, like the 90s, 80s and 90s or whatever. We had supermodels like Tara and like Naomi Campbell. And that's what I wanted to be. I was a tall, skinny little girl. I was 1 inch short of being a model. So I'm 5'6". If I would have been 5'7", I would have been a model. Because
it would have happened that way, huh?
It would have happened that way. I was just like, man, I get here and I can't even be a model. But I came out to visit my cousins when I was 16. And I always knew I wanted to come back. I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. I didn't want to be an actress. I don't think I ever wanted to be an actress. But I knew L.A. was where I was going to, something was going to happen for me here. Going to college and just kind of the college experience I had with interning with Def Jam and being around celebrities and stuff, it just kind of, I guess, ripened me to do what I was going to eventually do.
Wow. So that is so interesting that your family at a young age, like, girl, you're going to make it big time. I mean, you're going to be on Soul Train. We don't know what it is. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to go to L.A. I'm going to be a model. And then you graduate from college or you're doing internships and you're at Def Jam Records and you're like, okay, there's something here. So how did you find your path after, you know, you did the internships, Def Jam, you're like, should I go to New York and continue? Or should I go to LA and pursue the film? How did you get there? What was the critical step that you took that landed you where on this trajectory?
I will say that I didn't have access to comics really when I was growing up. The only comic book that was there was Archie and Veronica that was at the grocery store at Food Lion. So I would go there and I would always buy an Archie Veronica comic. So I was reading comics. I just didn't have access to all of them. So like Batman, I knew Wonder Woman because I was obsessed with her since I was a kid. I still remember walking around in my Wonder Woman like underwear and tank top. So that got to me. But like I think my freshman year of college, I took an African American theater class as an elective. And in the class, we had to write a play. So I decided to delve into my family history and write a play about my family. It was like the thing where like the light skin, dark skin thing where my great grandmother, her grandparents were dark skinned and lived in South Carolina. And they went to live with them and they were mistreating them because they were light skinned. Mm. So yeah, so it was interesting. So I wrote a play about it. They performed it in class. It was just a ruckus. It was comedy. It was crazy. And so I let my English professor read it just to see what she thought about it. And I still have it over there. She wrote on there, "This is really good, Shaquita. You should really consider screenwriting." And I was like, "What the hell is screenwriting?" And I just like shrugged it off and just kept like, "Oh, I'm in the music. I'm handing out tapes and stuff, and Def Jam, like the artists coming in town." So that was like for 3 years of college. And when I got to my senior year, my roommate from my freshman year, I ran into her on campus one day, and she was telling me like, "I really want to write television." And I was just like, "Oh, I'll help you research that because I'm good at researching things and finding opportunities." So I was like, "I'll help you research that." So once I was researching for her, I was just like, "I wonder if I can write a screenplay or I wonder if I can write a television show." And so I wrote, like, I was in the back of class. I remember writing show of For Your Love or something because that was a show that was on at the time. And so after I graduated from college, I went to Korea probably the next semester before I graduated. And when I came back, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And the story of Raven Troy was playing in my head. It was just like so many things like came into play, like for me, like everything like lined up. It was just like, okay, I know I want to be a writer. I want to be a storyteller because this is just too much. The story of Korea is I went to Korea on the study abroad trip, but it was with a cult, a religious cult. And I didn't know that until I got there. So coming back with that story, I knew I was a storyteller. Like, I'm definitely going to be a storyteller.
And for people who don't know, tell us who Raven Cho is so I can make sure. I may even be saying it wrong, but I want to make sure we understand that for people who don't understand completely comics and all of that.
Yes.
I want to kind of break that down. But that's pretty amazing that you went out there and that kind of solidified it. But kind of help us understand that a little bit more.
So Raven Choi is my 5-part graphic novel series. It's coming out as a trade paperback this year. It's about a girl. She's 5 years old. She witnesses a murder of her parents and they send her off to Korea as witness protection. She spends 20 years in Korea. She's adopted by a Korean family who's her father's best friend. She gets a clue and like her teddy bear that her dad left behind, decides to come to America to find the killer, and she becomes a bounty hunter in the process. She's kicking butt. She's with these two guys, Cassius and Dorian in DC, and they kind of help her solve the case. Now, since we have the books that are done, we're working on a prequel to kind of show her as a child growing up in Korea. So it's called Young Grandmaster Choi. We're doing a Kickstarter for it right now. It'll be over by the time this airs probably, but still, I'll still have the books to sell at that point. So we're working on the book. I'll show you what she looks like. This is Young Grandmaster Choi. This is my Gemini pillow.
That's so cool. So wait a minute. This all happened from going to overseas. You start writing the comic book series it was inspired by that trip.
I wrote a screenplay. So the second screenplay I ever wrote was Raven Choi. And I was just like, this summer, what if I came to Korea and I was adopted by a Korean family? Because they were so nice to me. Like when I was going around to little shops, I had like a roommate. It was just like, oh, you're so cute. You're so skinny. You're so beautiful. And they were just so sweet. And I was just like, okay, what if I actually lived here? Because some of them had never even seen a black person before. So I'm just like, how alienating must that be? Or just how like, you're just like the only person that they see that has dark skin. How would that be for someone? So the story of Raven Choi came to me when I came back from Korea, and then wrote it as a screenplay. I thought it might make a good comic book. And so we started drawing back in like 2002. We drew like an image of her just to kind of show what she would look like. And then years went by. It got me meetings in Hollywood. The script did, but never sold. So in 2014, I was like, let me start working on this as a graphic novel. I mean, I've been talking about it since 2008, but like I started working on it in secret, and we released the first two books in 2016. So it's been a journey.
Whoa. Girl, so this, I mean, that is just a ride, but how did you know that it was more than just the books? Because you went on to, you know, you have Shiro Comics, and that is, you know, your business name. So I can understand how you got the book idea and you're like, okay, I've got this, but how did it just like explode? Which it seems like everything in your life just explodes for some reason as I'm listening to you. But how did it just explode into a business, like a big time business?
It was because there was a dearth of black women in comics. Like when I was going to release the book, it was like, okay, well, I'm not going to release it under Raven Choi. I'm going to need a name of a publisher because I'm going to self-publish this. So I was writing, I was working with Coca-Cola. My territory was Beverly Hills, and I was riding through Beverly Hills one day, and Shiro just came to me and was like, Shiro, that's be a cool name for a comic book company. And so I was like, no, that's never going to be available. And so I went to look at like GoDaddy for the domain, and it was like Shiro Comics was right there. And I was just like, wow, nobody cares about women, because they haven't even thought about having women in this comic book space. This is crazy. So I bought the domain, and then it was just like, I was like, let me get a logo. So we did a logo. So it was all coming from like me having to have a publishing arm to release the books under. I felt I needed to have that. And so from that, it's just exploded into something way bigger than I ever imagined. Like when I first launched the first two books in 2016, I never saw a comic convention. I never saw having like doing games. That wasn't, I mean, that was always in the back of my head of like, maybe I'm going to do something in that space, but it was never like an action plan of we're going to do comics, films, and games. We're going to do prequels. We're going to make movies. We're going to make games. We're going to make comic books and several. That was never the jump off point when we started. It was just like, let me see how this goes. And so I think my first comic convention was in October of that year, Halloween. It was Stan Lee's Kamikaze is what it was called in Los Angeles. And I'm at my table, and we set up, we were doing really well with sales or whatever. And I had like a step and repeat, because that's just, I'm over the top. So I had like a step and repeat that said Shiro Comics. I had a pink carpet so people could come take pictures on my pink carpet. It was marketing, because the pictures that they took, my logo was in every Instagram post that they would post about it. So that was the goal. But this little black girl walked past my table, and her mom was holding her hand. She didn't stop. And they were walking past my table, and a little girl looked over, and she was like, Shiro. And the way she said it and the way she looked, I was just like, it was like chills. It was like,
oh, wow.
Okay, this is bigger than this is bigger than me and anything I could have ever imagined, because that reaction, that's what little black girls should have in this space of comic book world. They should have that company that's for them, that's doing things for them and in their likeness. And so from there, it was just like, all right, it's on. There's a need for this. There's a gap in the industry that's not being filled, and it doesn't seem like they're trying to fill it. So let me step on in here and do what I do.
I have to go back to that little girl, because sometimes, you know, you're thinking you're doing this because you love, you know, screenwriting, you love writing, you discover that. But then to uncover that there's like this bigger purpose to it.
Yes.
What is that like?
That is what keeps me going. That is what, for any negative thing that comes to me about my company or about my books, it's like, this is a purpose. This is bigger than you and me. So nothing you say is going to deter me. Nothing you say is going to downplay what I'm doing. Like, this is a God thing. Like, I'm supposed to be doing this. This is what my life is dedicated to at this point. So it makes it so you're kind of bulletproof, because it's like when you're operating in your purpose and you're doing things in your purpose, even like the rejections don't bother you as much, because you know it's going to happen. It's just like it's already happening in the future. It's just getting there.
That's good, because a lot of people, you know, they think they hear your story and it does seem like, whoa, you exploded. But like you said, there is rejection sometimes. There is people naysayers. Tell me about that. What was that like? And I know you said you almost felt like you were bulletproof, but I think that's a good message for people to realize that even when you're on purpose and you're operating in purpose, that you're still going to come up against resistance. So I would love to hear your insight.
I applied to probably over $1 million in grants last year and didn't get but one. I got one, and then that grant is happening this coming week. So it wasn't even happening in that year. So it's like the grant's not happening until this week. I'm going to Goldman Sachs for the 1 million Black Women Black in Business Initiative. Even though I'm operating in my purpose, even though I got the books together, we're working on a video game, I have all this stuff that's happening or whatever, I'm meeting with Hollywood or whatever, there was still $1 million in grant money that I didn't get. And the rejections would be like, some of the grants would be like, do you want to, you know, get feedback on what's your application? I'm like, sure, I would love to know what we can do better here or whatever. How can I improve? But even the rejections were like, oh, this is such a wonderful idea. So I'm just like, wait, you rejected me? But then you're going on and on for paragraphs talking about how great this is. So it's just like confusing, but it's just like, okay, maybe it's just not the time for that right now. Maybe I need to continue to bootstrap it through this year. And then next year is going to be the year where everything pops off even bigger or whatever. So yeah, it's a lot of rejection you go through, but you have to be able to bounce back from it. And that's where the purpose comes in, because if I didn't have that, if I didn't feel that off all my being, that this is my purpose, then all the rejections, I would have been done. I would have given up a long time ago. But there's a bigger theme at hand here. There's a bigger thing that's coming. So
what's that bigger thing? What do you feel like that bigger thing is?
For me, it's creating a character or creating something that's going to change the world and the world's perspective of Black women, especially. There's a lot of things that are out there, especially now because of social media. My problem with Tubi, let's talk about Tubi. My issue with Tubi and the types of films that they put out that people are online like laughing about, like, oh, this is so stupid, this looks horrible. It's just like, yeah, it's funny or whatever, and it's terrible movies or whatever, but those are the movies that go out to the world. Tubi is in other countries. So when I go to Korea and they've watched a Tubi film, and that's all they see is us like killing each other, all they see is us like twerking or whatever, that impacts the world. It makes an impact. The best example I can give is Coming to America and how impactful that movie still is, like 30 years later. People still,
my favorite movie.
Me too. People still quote that movie in Africa, everywhere else. They saw Black people coming together as like, I mean, it was like a farce. It was supposed to be a farce type of movie, but people took it seriously because it was like, it showed us in a positive way. It showed us as kings and queens. It showed us as him being humble and him falling in love with a woman. And so that's, the media is very impactful. So those Tubi movies that go out that you think, oh, ha, 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 no. And when you go to Korea, people are actually looking at you and they're probably afraid of you because they saw that film and they think that that's what all Black people are like, because they don't have Black people there. There's some parts of Korea where there aren't any Black people. So that's all they see of us. Like, kind of like when we see their movies, that's our representation of what we feel that was happening in Asia. So it's like, when you see that, that's what makes what I do important, because I need to be the reflection of what I think the world should see Black women as. And for little Black girls, they need role model, and I proudly step into that role. But there's so many other people that are not role models that they're looking up to because they have as many followers or whatever they have. So it's just like, I have to use this platform to fight against those things, because I think that's what I'm here to do.
And I love that, because you said, you know, first it starts out as the books, Raven Choi, then it leads into the business, Shiro Comics. Then next, you know, we have you doing Shiro Con, your own convention, Comic-Con kind of thing. And then what is next? What do you see in terms of all the expansion of what this could be?
Okay, so now the company is built. And I had this discussion with one of the grants last year. The guy was saying like, oh, well, it seems like you're putting everything on your games and that's going to be like the big thing or whatever. I'm like, oh, yeah, the games are going to be big because gaming is huge. Gaming is the future. Like, gaming is taking over film and television and every other entertainment. Like, I mean, it's billions and billions of dollars. And gaming reaches the whole world. So it's not just an American thing. It's everywhere. So now that we're at the gaming part and we've built a prototype for our new game, now is when I can go, the world is open to me. I can go get grants. I can go get venture capitalist money to build Shiro Games. I'm looking right now for a tech co-founder for Shiro Games because the techno side of games is just, I can get some things, but I'm not going to get all of that. So I need someone that understands that world that can kind of co-found this company with me. But yeah, now I have a complete multimedia company where it's not on the level of Marvel, but it's a smaller version of Marvel to where we're in our niche of women, of serving women, especially minority women, which are this money left on the table by the big studios because they don't really seem to care or think that women are valuable. I do. And so that's what the future is to now build out the company. Now that I've built so many IPs, now that I have so many films that have won awards, now that I have a game coming up or whatever, it's like the company is as a whole right now. So now I can move a little bit differently. Now I can go out and do Good Morning America and do the big media outlets or whatever because I have a complete company. And if we get money from venture capitalists, and that's even more news or whatever, black woman that gets $1 million to do games. So it's just like, and that's going to be something little girls can see and can aspire to do. So it's like trailblazing is what my therapist calls it. Like you're out here trailblazing. And so that's what's next, is to continue to trailblaze. Now that we have everything kind of settled, we have the IP built, now we can go out and let the world know, everybody, this is what we got going on. So like this week was me doing media, like sending media to Korean outlets, to outlets in Ireland, to outlets in the United States. So just like everywhere, this is what we have. This is what we've built. So now that I built something, I'm able to go out with it and build more and bring on more people. Because I want to bring in other women that write the books and other women that are creating comics and kind of acquiring things that they're doing as well. And going around the schools and using the books as educational tools. Like Raven Choi is in English and Korean. So people use it to kind of learn Korean. They're learning. They can use the books as a tool. So it's just like there's so many things that the world is my oyster really at this point.
Wow.
I've gotten to this point, bootstrapped to this point to where now anything is possible. Everything is where it's supposed to be and just waiting on, not really waiting, but just like thinking of what my next move is.
And I know when you talked about being kind of a smaller version of Marvel, do you see yourself doing more movies as well? I know you talked about moving into the gaming and you do have the documentary where you're documenting your journey, through this process and stuff. But do you also have a vision of that? Because I think we're seeing more of that with the Black Panthers and things like that. Like there's an audience for it. Is that another arm of your business that you really see catapulting in the future?
Yes. I came to California to write movies. So that's fundamentally, I'm a trained screenwriter who also has a business sense. So it's kind of like bringing those two worlds together. So film, that's the thing. You build these IPs up, and Raven Choi is built up to not just be a game, but to eventually be a film. Kind of like Tomb Raider, Lara Croft, kind of how you see that, where it's a multimedia empire that they've built around that character. So the same thing can happen for her and all the other characters that I've created, other heroes that I've created. That's the goal. With Young Grandmaster Choi, I think that one is just like the most explosive one because it's like little black girl Karate Kid. So it's like this little girl goes to Korea and learns Hapkido and Taekwondo and all these different martial arts, and she starts to take competitive sports world by storm. So it's like, when have you ever seen a little black girl in competition, and that's kicking butt, and it's in another culture, and it's overcoming her parents being killed. So it's just like at Comic Cons, a lot of the white guys tell me that the story of Raven Choi reminds them of Batman, and I'm like, Batman is the best selling comic book of all time. So I'm just like, I'm in good company, and that's what I'm aiming for. Like, we're coming for you. We're coming for the whole world to get into this. And so far, after doing that trip or that tour that we did, I think they're ready for it. Like in Indonesia, the women were so supportive. They were so happy to see a black woman doing it. They were buying the books. They were like telling me how proud they were of me. And it was just like, I was like in tears. It's just like, oh wow. Like I didn't expect this. Like I knew I was coming to a different country, but I didn't know that, they know our plight and were able to kind of relate to us on that level. Cause these are Muslim women. So yeah, it was really cool.
And you know what I think is really cool as well is the fact that you saw the gap.
Yes.
You said, okay, there is a gap in the industry. And I think that is oftentimes where we can find the next great opportunity, is looking for the gaps.
Yes.
When you're thinking about other women who might be, maybe it's not gaming or even media, but their own, trying to find their own purpose or place in the world. What would you say about identifying gaps or looking for places where there's a missing component where you can make your mark?
Well, usually you can start out with what you like. So for me, it was just like, I went into a comic book shop, I think after seeing the first Iron Man. I saw Iron Man and I was just like, I knew where Marvel was going. Like, I had my own vision, and it's hard for people to see your vision. It's hard to make them see your vision. But with Marvel, I knew exactly where they were going. I knew what they were trying to do. I knew it was going to get to where Black Panther or whatever. I kind of saw that. And I was just like, okay, so where are Black women and minority women going to be in that? Because they're just going to probably focus on men, because most of the comic books focus on men. So I was just like, well, let me go do my research, go see what's happening. So I went to the comic book shop down the street and was just like, okay, give me all the books you have with Black women on the cover, or Black women, or about Black women. And he was just like, I was just like, okay. So he gave me like Heroes for Hire, which had Misty Knight, but she was a part of a crew or whatever. He gave me Black Panther, which I think like Storm is in some of those books. And it was, I'm like, okay, well, she's not on the cover. Like, what about the Star? I mean, we Star and stuff too. We Black, you know. He's like, he had nothing for me. And so I was just like, wow. So there is a gap in here or whatever. And this was like in 2008, 2009. And so it was just like, okay, there is a place for me to put this Raven Choi character out in the world or whatever. And so how am I going to do that? So several years later, I wanted to do a couple films before I got around to doing the comic book. And so, yeah, it was just finding that there was a gap in something that I was interested in and something that I was passionate about, which is Black women in Hollywood and Black women in the media. And so that's what I would say, to find the gap in something that you're interested in, because that passion is what's going to take you through all the hard times and all the rejections. Because, girl, I've been rejected so many times. It's just like, but I keep coming back. It's like the phoenix. You keep rising and whatever. But that, you have to have that energy of knowing in your gut that this is what you're supposed to be doing, and knowing in your gut that this is what you have to do. It's something that you have to do. So that's what keeps you going and keeps, because it's very, very difficult. And in my world, it's even more so because of the sexism and the racism, and just being in the spaces where women aren't traditionally allowed, or they're not used to being there, which is comics.
Celebrated.
Mm-hmm. It's celebrated. And gaming, like right now, and gaming is still very new, the new part of my company. And I'm just seeing where it's just like, there ain't no Black people over here. And they're not, especially no women, and they're not interested in, they don't feel like obligated to bring women into the world of gaming. They don't, because they make so much money, and so much money internationally, that they don't have to be diverse. But I'm just like, oh, okay, well, we're going to be diverse over here. So I'm going to come in and take all of the money that y'all are leaving on the table by not being diverse. And that's what my path is in here. So it's just like the money y'all are leaving behind. And I'm just going to do it by creating excellent games, like not just a game or just a regular game. No, it's going to be excellent. That's one thing I learned from Coca-Cola, is if you have a really good product, it sells no matter what. Because some of the sales reps and the people that worked at Coca-Cola weren't the greatest, but we had a really great product. And those people that had been drinking Coke since they were little, they had stories behind the Coca-Cola. And it's like, if you have that and you build that kind of product for your consumers, then there's nowhere you can't go. It's just, it's endless. It's boundless.
The sky's the limit.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get ideas? Mm. You know, do things just come to you? Because I know you talked about when you came up with your first character, you know, you had just come back from Asia and you're like, oh, what would happen if I was over there and I was raised by family? What would my life be like? So how do you find ideas? Does it just come to you?
Usually just life. Like when I came back 2018, when I came back from Indonesia, that was the last stop on the tour. I did an interview with Simone Missick. She played Misty Knight in Luke Cage. And she has a show that's on right now that gets on OWN, where she plays a judge, Lola Carmichael. And I interviewed her for the documentary. And I remember telling her at the interview, like, you remind me of Pam Grier. And I'm like, and she was so regal and like the way she would answer the questions and stuff. And so after that, I was just like, I think she's really cool or whatever. And so I asked my mom for a DNA test. It was like right before Christmas. And so she bought me a DNA test. She was quick with it. And it came in a couple weeks. And so I was still thinking about everything that just happened this year. So I finally took the test maybe in January. But then the test gave me an idea. It was just like, what if this test, like, what if someone comes out of the blue? What if I'm like kin to some tribe, or I'm like some kingdom in Africa or something like that? And that's where like the story for Taking the Throne. So I ended up coming up with this story. I pitched it to this incubator that Ron Howard and Brian Grazer had, and they wanted me to come in and write it. So I went in and wrote this movie in 8 weeks. And that's kind of, that's how Taking the Throne came about. It was like, I interviewed Simone, I took a DNA test and got this idea. And then I kind of wrote it out as a pitch. And they were like, they interviewed me and they were like, okay, you want to be a part of this program. And so this was like this, like ShiroCon number one, it was ShiroCon number one that happened. And then the next day I get a call from Ron Howard. So it was just like,
and Ron Howard's huge. I mean,
yes, he is.
To call you, girl, yes. That is huge.
Yes, it was, I was just like, cause I was on the phone with somebody else about ShiroCon, cause ShiroCon, they had messed up my colors on my step and repeat. So I was on the phone with them like, yeah, the colors were wrong. I want my money back. And I get a call from Beverly Hills. I was like, hold on. So I'm like, I click over and it's like Ron Howard. I'm just like, wait, what? So yeah, but it was just like, so ideas come to me like from talking to people, from going to the park, from being in the shower, or maybe I see something wrong. I'm looking and reading something. I'm like, what does that say? Oh, well, that might make a good idea. Like, I think it was like I was listening to the radio one day and they were saying something about bad moms or bad something. And I was just like, bad moms, like that might be a good idea for a show or something like that. So it's like the ideas just kind of come to me. And some of them are stronger where it's just like, this has to get written now. And some of them are just like, I can do those later. So they have like a sheet of just different ideas. I'm an idea person. And so they kind of come to me in any kind of way.
Well, before we get to some additional wisdom, just from your journey, I want to talk about what's the best way people can support you? Because we're hearing what you're doing. We want to be a support to you. We want to let the community know, or if you're a woman and you're watching this and we have this, you know, Shaquita is doing the thing. We need to put our support behind her and show her some love. So what's the best way people can do that?
Best way is to ShiroComics.com is my website. So, and on social media, I'm at ShiroComics. So it's Hero with an S on the front, of course. So ShiroComics, I'm everywhere. I'm on Twitter. I'm on TikTok somehow. I'm on Facebook. Where else am I? I'm on LinkedIn, so you can follow me on there. But yeah, just follow me and definitely support and buy the books, because that's what helps push things along. And it helps my numbers, because when I go into these meetings or go into looking for venture capitalists or whatever, they want numbers. It's like, how many books are you selling? It was like during the Comic-Con circuit, I was selling 800 books a year, pretty much, which was really decent for indie or whatever. But it's like now it's like I don't sell as many books because there's nothing really pushing it. But now that, like I said, we've reached a point where we're at games now, so I can kind of be on the media circuit now and kind of push things and get more followers and all of that to kind of bring them along. But that's where you can find me, is Shiro Comics.
No, I think that's important, like you said, because the numbers, the, you know, the movie people, all of those are looking at the numbers. So, yes, you know, every follower, every book sold, all of that makes a significant difference. You may feel like you're one person, but, you know, I want the audience to know that one person, if we have one person on top of one person on top of one person, just the impact that can make. So going into some of the wisdom from your journey, what do you think were some of the biggest mistakes you made early on that you would change if you looking back?
Looking back, there was like, I like to do experiential marketing sometimes. When we first came out with the first book, I was trying to see, like, instead of just going into comic book shops, I was like, well, let me see if I can sell this into like hair supply stores and other places or whatever to kind of see if it would work there. And for the most part, it didn't. It was just like, because people that like comics go to comic book shops. So it was like, I probably wouldn't have done that. I mean, I did it now. So you know that I can tell everybody else, like, that's not really where it works at. It may work in a way depending on like the media strategy you have going on it. But for me, that wasn't successful. Where else probably is spending my own money. So, you have to bootstrap in a way, but I think this is my first Kickstarter that I'm running right now. I did I Fund Women. I raised money on their platform back in 2021 because I got a grant from Caress. Long before this, I probably should have done a couple of Kickstarters, because that's the way a lot of comic book creators are selling their books. And that's where a big audience is that will support your books. So I probably should have crowdfunded. It's a way of marketing as well. So people get to know you through Kickstarter.
Yeah, because it's crowdfunding and I want to make sure people understand that. So if you don't understand what Kickstarter is, it's like a crowdfunding way where you put your idea out there and people are able to invest in your business. So maybe the big top company didn't, but you're saying, looking back, saying go crowdfunding route, look at other options.
If you can, if you have a support system, like this campaign right now that's going on, like I'm at $6,049, I believe right now. The goal was 5,000. I knew that I could raise 5,000 with just friends and family. And most of them have just given me money They don't even want anything, any rewards. So what happens is like we got to 5,000 and kind of right now we're kind of stuck at 6,000 because people see it and they're like, oh, she was only raising 5,000, so we're not going to give her anything more. But my counterparts and what's happening for them on there is that they'll put a goal for 3,000 and end up with like $30,000-$40,000 because their crowd is not just coming to support them to get the book made, but they're actually buying the book. So that's where I'm at right now, is trying to explain to people that may not be necessarily be privy of Kickstarter is that, okay, we're at our goal. We're over our goal at this point, but I still need you to buy books. These are pretty much me selling advanced copies of the book. So after this call, that's my next thing. I'm going to do like a little trailer, a little commercial to kind of show, okay, we made it to our goal. This is what we need. We need to sell books now because I need to have numbers when I go into the studios about this being an animated TV series. I need to have numbers like, okay, we sold $20,000 worth of books or whatever, because like I say, numbers matter. Yeah, it's just like trying to get that is what, well, you see the differences between me and like my male counterparts. It's like their stuff kind of blows up because it's more men who, I guess, read comics. But I think there are women that read comics too, and men read my comics as well. So it's just finding that audience is what I think was, it's like I could have done that a lot sooner by going on Kickstarter a lot sooner. So that was kind of a thing where I felt like, okay, you should have been on here, Shaquita.
No, I think that's a couple good golden nuggets from there is don't be afraid to look at alternate sources of income for your business. Like you said, the Kickstarters, the crowdfunding, looking at that.
Yeah.
And then also what I like that you said is you experimented, but maybe not staying in that experimental phase so long.
Yeah.
I was like, let me see if I can sell this in the beauty stores, but saying, okay, where is your audience? Really honing in and knowing your audience, because once you know where your audience is, then you would have said, oh, they're not really there. So let me go back to the comic book stores and see how I can infiltrate there and continue to raise awareness. So I think that's really huge.
And asking for help.
Ooh,
asking for help.
That's good.
Because that's the thing that we don't do often is ask for help. And that's where I had to get out of that. It's just kind of doing everything on your own and kind of stressing yourself out, doing stuff like ask for help when you need it. So now I have a virtual assistant that does my research for me, or I'll get interns that come in and they help or whatever. So ask for help when you need it because you can burn out.
Yeah, because I can imagine all the stuff that you're doing and even just continuing to ideate and come up with a new idea. So you have to have the creative side of your brain, but also the business side of your brain. So all of that working together, I can see how that can be a lot. So one of the last questions I want to say to you is, what is the biggest mindset shift that you think you've had to make throughout all of this? I know you talked about pivoting, but was it believing in yourself? What was the biggest mindset shift that you think was the most impactful besides the pivot? Because I think the pivot is huge. But is there any other mindset?
I think I'm going through that now. I saw one of my friends last night. I sent my text message. I'm like, I'm at the... So before I moved out here, I told you it was like two roads, New York, LA. Which one are you going to do? So right now I'm at a point where I've met with everybody in Hollywood. I have a brand new script that's out, that's going out or whatever. And it's like, I came here to write movies. So it's like, okay, either this script is going to sell, I'm going to get on a TV series to write on a show right now, or I'm going to take Shiro Games and find a tech co-founder and go to venture capitalist. But I know that if I go do Shiro Games and get venture capitalist, you have other people's money. So you're running a company now. So I won't have as much time to write movies. So it's like, okay, where am I going next, God? Am I going to do games right now? Or am I going to do screenwriting? Because the screenwriting side of things, it's like, okay, I can make money. I can still bootstrap and get grants and kind of build my gaming company a little bit at a time. But I'm not beholden to anyone where I'm having to like run this company to get them their money back to be profitable. I can still do it a little bit at a time while I'm writing, which I'm happiest when I'm writing. But the gaming side of things has become to where it's like movies. You're telling stories. So the Last of Us is playing on HBO. That's so huge right now. If you go and look at the game looks like a movie. And so there's storytelling that's happening there where I have stories, I have comic books that are going to become a game and that can look just like that. So it's like either way it goes, there's a bag of money. So it's not a horrible place to be, but it's still like, okay, where am I going now? Am I going the venture capitalist route, or am I going the Hollywood route. So it's like the next month, probably I'll figure that out, because I have some big meetings with Hollywood folks and production companies about the script and about Young Grandmaster Choi. But then I also am applying to cohorts that are investing in businesses and that are going to want you to make your business profitable and to move forward with the gaming side of things. And the game, like I say, it's complicated to build a game. It's finding the right team and all that. So it's going to take every bit of me to ensure that that's happening and that I'm the boss. I'm the CEO. I mean, I am the CEO, but I'm really the CEO over here. Like every day I'm just focused on the gaming or whatever. So I'm in that mindset right now of, okay, where am I going here? And so in the next month, it'll work itself out. But that's where I'm in the mindset of, like, I have to figure out what my next move is in this business. And with this company, where am I taking this company?
Well, I know for sure, no matter which way you go, it's going to blow up, which you're passing. So I almost, even as I'm listening to you, I'm like, you could go either direction and it will be amazing. And I think that eventually all of it will come to play. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that because I have like a crystal ball or anything, but I just feel like everything that you have touched and the path that you're on, that you're being led. And even if you go here, I feel like God's kind of like a GPS system, I almost feel. You go down, you get a little kind of off route. He kind of reroutes you and you're back where you're supposed to be anyway.
Yeah, that is true. That's what God does.
Yeah, so I always feel like, you know, it will all work itself out. And so I'm excited to see where you're going to end up or how this is all going to unfold. And my two last questions for you, because I only thought I had one, but when you started talking about meeting with Hollywood and doing that, how did you start opening those doors or even get the courage to say, I'm going to start going after these big contracts or finding the people? Because I think that's another thing on your journey is knowing who to contact, where to go. How do you even open the door, even get the meeting? So if there's any insight you can give to that, I think that would be really helpful.
Before the Ron Howard program, it was just me hustling and meeting people. That's how I got myself an InStyle magazine. I went to an event, I met the editor, and at this event, it was really strange because it was BeautyCon and they just did a talk. And so the lady came downstairs. I was telling her, like, yeah, I want to get into the magazine. This is what I'm doing. Here's my book or whatever. But there were these girls that were around me and they all had heard of Shiro Comics. So they were just like, oh yeah, we know about Shiro Comics. And so I'm sure that made it look even better. I'm just like, really? Like, okay. So that was interesting. But then a couple months later, I did the Ron Howard thing. And that's where it was kind of like a big break, because at that point I got management. I had agents that were chasing me at that point in time because of the script that I had written. And then I was getting meetings. I met with Kevin Hart's company, Will Smith's company. I mean, everybody, Reese Witherspoon's company. I met with so many people that year. And then it continued. I signed with the agents probably in 2020, right before the pandemic happened. And then that got me even more meetings. So I was pitching on movies for like Mattel and pitching on Lego movie or just all these movies or whatever I was pitching on. And so But while I was doing that, I made sure that I was creating a relationship with the people at the company. So I would get their information. I would send them my Raven Choi books afterwards, and I would keep in touch with them. So every time I would release a book, hey guys, I have a new book coming out or whatever, so I can keep that relationship going. And so now at this point, like, I let go of my managers last year because it wasn't working out. It wasn't a fit. And then my agents kind of they left like last month, which was like, okay, nothing's going to stop here. Cause I'm like, I don't think they understood the whole CEO and being the game. Like, yeah, we appreciate the games and the comics or whatever, but they never understood it. They only understand Hollywood and screenwriting and stuff. And I'm just like, I need someone that gets all of that. So it's just like, okay, so they left or whatever, but I still have this sheet of all the people that I met in Hollywood that I've kept in touch with. And so I set up my own meeting. So yesterday I met with this really big production company. Next month I'm meeting with the production company that did Top Gun, Maverick. I just met with another producer about Hallmark movies that I write. And so it's just like, it's going to happen with or without me having representation at this point. But it's just like cultivating those relationships and making sure people know who you are. They know me as a really good writer. So that gives me respect coming through the door. So they know that I'm not writing crap. So they're requesting my script from me now rather than requesting from the agent or having to go through a third party. I mean, I still have my lawyer who kind of navigates and is my point person. But yeah, at this point, it's just like I've created these relationships with Hollywood. And now I can utilize them without having a middle person there. And I think it makes it more like intimate. It makes it more like, wow, she's really, you know, doing it. She's really entrepreneurial, because that's what the lady told me yesterday. She's like, you're such an entrepreneur. And so it's just like, that's kind of how I've had to work it. It's just like the meetings that I did get through representation, I made sure I got my own relationship with them. So they, if things went south, or if I decided to fire my agents down the road, a couple months down the road, then it didn't matter, because I already have these relationships with Universal Studios and other production companies or whatever. So right now, I'm just like focused on this campaign and having meetings with them about Young Grandmaster Choi and everything else that I have in my arsenal. And it's like I say, like it's next month. It's like either if something's going to sell, I'm going to be on a show writing a superhero character, or I'm going to be over here doing games and going to Silicon Valley to get the money that I need. And I know that there's not many women that are doing what I'm doing. I know I stand out as a Black woman that's doing this. I know that I'm creating excellent products and excellent IP. I know I have everything that I need. And so it's win-win.
Oh, wow. Girl, you inspire me. I just have to say, listening to you and your belief in yourself and your willingness to just keep putting yourself out there and not letting anything stop you is huge. And so the last question I like to end with on my guests, because I could probably talk to you all day and just pick your brain, because you're such a and you're so inspiring and have such a wealth of information. But I always ask people, what is the best piece of advice that you've received on your journey?
Before I moved here, the one time I came out to visit, I had emailed, I used to mail letters to my TV shows in Hollywood I wanted to write on. So I remember the Parkers was going on. And so I wrote them a letter about being on the show or as a writer's assistant or something like that. And the lady who was like the assistant to the showrunner, she wrote me back. She loved the way I packaged the letter. I'm just a Gemini. Everything's different. So the paper was cut a certain way. The way I typed the letter, I put it in like an envelope that you can see through. It was just like my presentation was always going to be like over the top. And so she was just like, the paper, everything about it, like, who are you? And so she like sent me a message and was like, well, yeah, let me know if you're in LA and I can get you tickets to come on the show or whatever. And so I was just like, okay, cool. So I'm like, I'm in LA next week. So that was an invitation for me. I'm like that Martin episode, like I'm here for now. So I get here and I meet her. I think her name was Sherry McGee. And the best advice that she gave me was to not just write Black stuff. She was like, don't just write Black stuff, write about everybody, write everything that you can, make it diverse. And that was the best piece of advice, because the first agent that I had was before I moved here, and it was off of, I wrote a spec script, but a sample script of the Lizzie McGuire show. And I think I wrote another one of the Drew Carey show. So I would write the rest of development. So I was able to write across the board, white, Black, Korean, whatever. And that's been my superpower in the industry. I'm able to, like I say, I'm able to pitch on movies to write like Pictionary, or pitch on movies to write like Lego or sci-fi movies or whatever that comes along. I'm able to do that because of that piece of advice. And the same thing with my company. It's just like, yeah, I'm focused on minority women and especially Black women, but I mean, it's really all women too. Like I think all women are, like I said, in Indonesia, like they were like happy that a Black woman with a Black story, they supported me like the most. So it was just like, I think other women want us to win as well. So it's like my company, it serves Black women, but it also serves all women. So eventually I want Indonesian women telling their stories through She-Ro comics. It's the She-Ro universe. Mm. That's the best advice I got, was to not just focus on just Black stories and to be able to write everybody's. And that's what's helped me.
Yeah, diversify. That's huge. Just being willing to diversify, being open to the pivot, as you said.
Yeah.
Being willing to bet on yourself, invest in yourself, and just watch and see how God is strategic and will open the doors at the right time with the right people to become and do the purpose that he's called you to do. So this has been such a good, oh my gosh, I love this conversation, Shaquita. This has been so good for my soul, and I know that it is going to bless so many people. So thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you.
What was your biggest aha moment from today's show? For me, it was the importance of believing bigger and how God kept telling Shaquita bigger every time her vision was too small. It makes me question, what areas in my life is God saying, I have greater for you? Powerful. If you were inspired by the women you hear on my podcast, please share this with a friend. It would mean a lot to me. Subscribe to the show so you don't miss any episodes, and leave me a review. Your support will help more women find us. To learn more about our guests, visit shesbigtimenow.com. Thank you so much for listening.